Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. We begin today looking back at Pope Benedict's trip to Cuba with a local analysis of what impact it might be having on the island nation. Putting rosaries in the hands of Cubans, one Catholic charity sends thousands to Cuba with how-to guides to use them. Britain's embassy to the Holy See organizes a colloquium to celebrate 30 years of full diplomatic relations. We talk with the British ambassador and preparing for Holy Week. Jesuit priest Chris Bowles reflects on why he approaches Holy Week with very mixed feelings. Pope Benedict XVI returned to Rome Thursday after a six-day visit to Latin America that took him first to Mexico and then to Cuba. As he left Cuba, the Holy Father called on all the people of the country to open their hearts to Christ's gospel so as authentically to renew their personal and social life. Commentators have already begun speaking about what kind of impact the visit of the Pope will have on Cuba. Jesuit Bishop Luis del Castillo Estrada is the retired Bishop of Mayo in Uruguay. After his retirement, he was asked by the Jesuits to serve as a parish priest in Cuba. He told Vatican Radio, "It is important to understand the nature of the pastoral visit of Pope Benedict to the island nation."
I think the visit was exceptionally good, but in order to understand what we can expect for the future from this visit, we have to place the event in context. First, the global context of a world that is worried because of economic instability, difficulty in national governance and international relations, and also a worry for the overall ecology of the continent and the world. Responsibility in front of this context is that in order to overcome all these difficulties, we need honest, ethical people. The second context is the context of Cuba. The president, Raúl Castro, in his speech welcoming the Pope at the airport, stated that the government is prepared to change all that has to be changed. So we're in a context of internal change. The Sixth Congress of the Communist Party last year established a number of guidelines in order to adjust the economy of the country to new times in the world economy and internally to increase production, especially of food.
Cuba today has to import 80% of all food products. This situation means that there is a growing movement inside the country calling for change.
The third context is the context of the church. This visit takes place in and as an event within a national jubilee, Marian jubilee, in the 400th anniversary of the discovery of an image of Our Lady that over the centuries has become the patron of Cuba, not just for the Roman Catholics, but for the population at large as an icon of the Cuban nationality.
Tens of thousands of Cubans, what Bishop Castillo Estrada calls rivers of people, celebrated the Jubilee as the statue of Our Lady of Charity of El Cobre was carried throughout towns, cities, and rural areas for veneration by Christians and non-Christians.
Obviously, not just practicing Catholics, but people from all walks of life, of all ideologies, and all religious convictions have a very particular relationship to this image of Our Lady.
The Pope's visit should be seen in the context of an improving relationship, he says, between the Church and different religious convictions and the government.
The Church, the Roman Catholic Church in Cuba, is experiencing an increase in newcomers, the challenge today is to prepare sufficient numbers of adult catechists for people who may have been baptized as children, but then were absent from church for decades and come back to church now. So we have more newcomers than old-timers. This requires evangelization and catechesis. There's also new presence in the rural areas and suburban areas where there are no churches through what are called casas mission, or homes where neighbors gather weekly for Bible study, catechesis, and when the priest is available, even the Eucharist and other sacraments, baptism and confession.
When studying relations between church and state, one should take into account, he says, an important speech given by Raul Castro to the National Assembly on August 1st, 2011.
He was very, very clear in expressing that there has to be a change in attitude in relation to the people who practice any religion. And I think it is worth looking at this speech and quoting what the president has to say in front of assembly and all the state apparatus from top to the local authorities. Both Raul Castro's speech and the Pope's message, and also the president of the Bishops' Conference in his welcoming address at the Mass in Santiago, there is an expression, a desire, a wish for a broader participation of Christians in public life. This will be a challenge for the government to open the private sector that today is practically inexistent to brainstorming, creativity, initiatives, and also sharing in creating new country. This was expressed in different ways. A country that is more open to the world, a country that is an expression of human rights in all the extension of these human rights. I think this is one of the expected results from this visit.
And a warm thanks there to Jesuit Bishop Luis del Castillo Estrada, speaking to us there from Cuba. A Catholic charity has donated a quarter of a million rosaries for the people of Cuba to mark the Pope's visit to the island. The charity Aid to the Church in Need also gave leaflets with each rosary explaining how to pray it. In addition, the pack included 15,000 children's rosary booklets and 10,000 prayer boxes containing a rosary ring, a small bottle of holy water, a pocket crucifix, and basic prayers. The rosaries contained an image of Our Lady of Charity of El Cobre, venerated, as we know, as Cuba's patron saint. Well, John Pontifex is head of press and information in the UK for Aid to the Church in Need, and he spoke to my colleague Anne Schneibel about the reasons which prompted this prayerful initiative.
We know that Cuba as a country has suffered very considerably over the years as a result of a crackdown on the church that took place essentially in the 1960s, and which led to many priests being forced into exile and very many religious sisters likewise. A number of schools and other church buildings were confiscated. And the result of this, of course, is that over the many years since the Castro brothers took power, we've seen it being very difficult for people to express their Christian faith. But things have changed, and we see that there is now the beginnings of a real opening up of the church. And so there's a lot of work to be done. And essential to that task is to focus energies around the devotion to Our Lady of Cobre, the national saint, the patron saint of Cuba, and which the organization I work for, Aid to the Church in Need, is primarily involved in supporting. So with that shrine now celebrating its 400th anniversary since the first sighting of the statue that gave rise to the shrine, and with the Pope going to Cuba, it seemed what better time to do this. And so we're very delighted that we're able, as an organization, to send out 250,000 rosaries to Cuba. And each of these rosaries has a little statue, really, of Our Lady of Cobre, which forms a sort of medallion at the heart of the rosary.
How else is the Aid to the Church in Need involved with the mission in Cuba?
Yes, what we as an organization are doing is to, as well as providing the rosaries, to provide 250,000 leaflets explaining how to pray the rosary. Then there are the 15,000 children's rosary booklets and the 10,000 prayer boxes, each containing a rosary, a ring, a small bottle of holy water, and a small pocket crucifix, as well as a little booklet with basic prayers in it. So these are just some of the ways in which ACN is active in the area.
And finally, what are your hopes for the Holy Father's visit to Cuba?
Well, we know that Pope Benedict XVI, as he's approached Cuba, has spoken out in favor of religious freedom. And we know at the same time that, as I said earlier, the situation regarding church-state relations has improved in great measure. So what we're doing is wanting to capitalize on the progress that has been made. And we appeal as an organization for true religious freedom to be granted to the people of Cuba and for those of all faiths, not just Christianity, of all faiths, to be given the right within the law and within the statutes that make up the governing of the country, to be able to go about their life of faith in a way that mutually supports the upbuilding of the society.
And that was John Pontifex from the charity Aid to the Church in Need. The British Embassy to the Holy See sponsored a colloquium Friday here in Rome, celebrating three decades of full diplomatic relations. Entitled Britain and the Holy See, a celebration of 1982 and the wider relationship, the event marks the 30th anniversary of the upgrading of relations just ahead of Pope John Paul II's historic pastoral visit to England, Scotland, and Wales in May 1982. The colloquium, hosted by the Venerable English College, included Catholic and Anglican church leaders from around Britain, as well as diplomats and historians, exploring the past, present, and future of both ecumenical and diplomatic relations between the two states. While the events of 1982 marked an important milestone on the road to post-Reformation reconciliation, the history of relations between Britain and the Holy See stretches much further back. In fact, the current British ambassador describes it as the oldest relationship that his government maintains with any state in the world. Ahead of the colloquium, Ambassador Nigel Baker talked to Philippa Hitchin about this colorful history and about shared contemporary concerns at the top of his agenda today.
As long as there has been, in that case, a King of England and a Pope, there have been relations between courts of different ways. But the first person who is commonly regarded as the ambassador, the English ambassador to the Holy See, was John Sherwin, who was appointed by King Edward IV in 1479. So in terms of a permanent relationship, he is in fact our first ever permanent ambassadorial appointment overseas. So I always claim that I represent the oldest British embassy in existence. And that sort of relationship, although of course there was a long gap during the period of the Reformation.
That of course was just shortly before the break with Rome, wasn't it?
Yeah, and an ambassador did return during the reign of Queen Mary. His tomb is, in fact, up at St. Gregory the Great Monastery here in Rome. But there was that long break from Queen Elizabeth through until the re-establishment of a diplomatic relationship in 1914.
Just at the beginning or at the outset of the First World War. What was the significance of that, do you think?
I think it demonstrated why the British government felt the need to have a relationship with the Holy See once again. There had been all sorts of unofficial both representatives and attempts to strengthen relationship during the 19th century. But when war broke out in 1914, the Allied countries, Britain, France and Russia, realised that they did not have a representative here at the Holy See, at a time when Benedict XV was, of course, very active in his efforts to initially prevent the outbreak of war, and once it had broken out, to find ways to bring the warring parties to a table. Now, for various reasons, France and Russia weren't able to move rapidly, but the United Kingdom decided that this was the time to have diplomatic relations once again. So appointed at the time a minister, so one step below ambassador level, who presented credentials right at the end of 1914, and an apostolic legate was also duly appointed to in the United Kingdom. So we'll soon be celebrating about 100 years of diplomatic relationship, but it remained at minister level from 1914.
Until 1982, that was when full diplomatic relations were restored at the beginning of April, just shortly before the first ever papal visit to London.
Exactly. My predecessor, Sir Mark Heath, who was here as minister, presented his credentials on the 1st of April, 1982, which is why this event is taking place on the 30th of March, as close as we can to that date. And I think both sides recognise, both the Holy See and the British government recognise, that with the visit of Pope John Paul II, as you say, the first ever visit of a reigning pontiff to the United Kingdom, that our relationship had matured sufficiently to put it on a full ambassadorial level. And therefore, although the visit was a pastoral visit, it was not a state visit like the visit we've just had from Pope Benedict XVI in 2010, it was clearly a significant moment in the relationship between the United Kingdom and the Holy See, and appropriate that we had a full ambassador and a full apostolic nuncio to take the relationship forward following the visit.
It's quite significant, isn't it, that until just very recently, until your immediate predecessor, the ambassador had to be an Anglican. And this, in a way, underlines both the political but also the religious dimension of this relationship.
The fascinating thing about this relationship, it is multidimensional. It is not like any other diplomatic relationship that we have. It operates on a local level. There is a Catholic community in the United Kingdom that, of course, is directly engaged in this relationship. A traditional bilateral relationship, you might say, United Kingdom related to the world of the Vatican City State. But I'm accredited to the Holy See, and therefore it enters into a completely different level, the global Catholic Church. So it operates on many, many different dimensions, and clearly an ambassador to the Holy See has to, as he would in any other country, but be able to understand and appreciate the particularities of the government, the organisation to which he's accredited. If you don't understand religion or are not interested in religion, I suspect the Holy See is probably not the best post for you.
You mentioned the 2010 state visit of Pope Benedict to the UK. That really gave a very significant boost to this relationship, didn't it?
It really did. And somebody said to me, oh, why are you celebrating 1982 when, of course, you've now moved even further now with the 2010 visit? And my thesis really is that 1982 was a crucial step along that path. It was a pastoral visit. Pope John Paul II was in Wales, and Scotland was in England. And I think one can say quite fairly that 2010 would not have been possible without 1982, but you're absolutely right. 2010 was another further enormous step forward. The fact that it was a state visit, the fact that it went way beyond the pastoral dimension, it demonstrated the incredible richness of the relationship between the United Kingdom and the Holy See in all sorts of different areas. And, of course, also the extraordinary speeches of Pope Benedict, particularly the speech in Westminster Hall, which addressed directly the complicated and complex nature of the historical relationship between Britain and the Holy See.
And the role of faith in public life today. It's still a very difficult question, isn't it? A controversial question for many.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, there's been a lot of debate about that in the United Kingdom recently. We had the visit of our British government delegation here and Baroness Wasey talking very forcefully about the importance of faith in British society. The day after that visit, Her Majesty the Queen visited Lambeth Palace, was received by the Archbishop of Canterbury and other religious leaders. And she too addressed precisely this question of the importance of faith as a defining force, really, in the sort of complicated tapestry which has helped to make up the British character in different ways, in different parts of the United Kingdom, and not just talking about the Christian faith or the established church, but talking about the relationship between Anglicanism, its role in generating understanding of faith, and its relationship in relationship with the state with the Catholic Church, other Christian churches, with Islam, with Hinduism, with Judaism, with atheism. Faith has always been part of British makeup and always been really there at the centre of British society, going back to 1982, 1914, 1479, or even further.
The obvious question, I suppose, then, is the challenges for the future. What are you hoping to do, in a sense, during your time here, but to build on these significant steps that have taken place just recently?
Well, we have an extraordinary agenda of work to take forward with the Holy See. I think quite a lot of that was encapsulated in a joint communique that the Holy See and the British government signed during the visit. A range of areas where we've got a lot to do together, working together against discrimination on faith grounds, for example, in different parts of the world, in sort of human rights work, looking at how we can work together in the aid and development area. Africa, we talked about particularly, and we're delighted with the support of the Holy See for the conference on Somalia that the Prime Minister hosted in London just a week or so after that visit. Areas in culture, the important role of the Catholic Church can play in the role of reconciliation in Northern Ireland. Every time I sort of look at my to-do list, it seems to get longer and longer because the relationship is very broad and I think quite untapped in a lot of different areas. We have these two extraordinary networks, the British network, our own diplomatic missions, plugging into the Commonwealth network, this network that the Holy See, its own diplomatic missions, but also the broader Catholic Church. There's a lot we can do together, working, you know, for the common good, and I think we can explore these more fully, both on the British side and the Holy See side. I think perhaps one could say, going back, not in perhaps in immediate history, but some years before, you know, perhaps we neglected the possibilities, and now's the time to really redo something together.
This colloquium is going to reinforce that. It's very much looking back at the history, isn't it? You've got some top historians, Anglican and Catholic experts, but I also, I imagine, looking ahead again to the challenges, to the areas, these unexplored areas, as you call them.
No, as a historian, I'm a great believer that you can't understand your present and you can't really try and even make an effort at working out your future unless you know something about your past. So it is looking back at 1982, but it's very much looking back with a contemporary eye. We have churchmen who will be coming who were very much involved in the 1982 visit, like Cardinal Cormac, like Cardinal Kirkpatrick O'Brien, and others who, but you know, that now they are in important positions and they very much are a part of the present of the Catholic Church in Britain. We'll be looking at the ecumenical relationship between Anglicanism and Catholicism. Looking back to 82, the Vatican II, the Vatican Council, but also very much where it is now and what we're going to be doing looking ahead. And these are all, that's also very much the facet, the key aspect of the historical relationship we want to bring out. The diplomatic relationship, you know, there's a story. It goes back to 1914 and before. It looks to 1982, to the present. But you know, part of that story is, you know, our unknown relationship looking ahead. And I'm delighted that we've got, you know, as a final session, we're going to be looking at the 19th century, and particularly we've got Eamon Duffy, who's going to be talking about Cardinal Newman, the blessed Cardinal Newman. Part of the 2010 visit was one of the most important aspects of that was the beatification of Cardinal Newman. And perhaps Eamon Duffy will be looking forward to possible future canonisation of the blessed Cardinal Newman in his talk during the colloquium. So it really is, it's about past, it's about now, but it's going to be looking ahead as well.
British Ambassador Nigel Baker there, speaking to my colleague Philippa Hitchin. Well, with the Church about to head into the holiest week of its liturgical calendar, Scottish Jesuit priest Chris Bowles reflects on why he finds preparing for this key week leading up to Easter such a daunting prospect.
The high point of the season of Lent is Holy Week, which is a week I approach with very mixed feelings. I always look forward to Palm Sunday and the procession and the blessing of palms, that brief encounter that we have with nature that greets Jesus as he enters the city of Jerusalem. But the happiness of the palm procession, well, it's pretty short-lived because, of course, our focus quickly turns to the reading of the Passion, reminding us, as if we needed reminding, why we call it a Holy Week. In all of the Gospels, we find Jesus teaching his disciples and showing them by example what it means to be great, what it means to be a leader. And he's doing this right to the end, to the very moment he shares his final meal with all his friends. And of course, the shock in it all is that to be a leader, Jesus insists that we have to be a servant. To be great, we have to be at the service of everyone. But Jesus doesn't just talk the talk, as they say. He lives it out. He lives out precisely this leadership. And we might even say that we see him at his best in the Passion story, in this week we call the Holy Week. I often wonder why we call it a Holy Week and not a dreadful week or an awesome week or the Passion Week. I was preparing a Palm Sunday homily once and I looked for help from the Oxford English Dictionary. I looked up the adjective holy there, which the dictionary describes as morally and spiritually excellent or perfect. Another definition it offers is belonging to, devoted to, or empowered by God. It also tells us that the adjective can be used in trivial exclamations, such as holy cow, holy mackerel, holy smoke. And I suppose that Holy Week might be pretty trivial for many people. But for many others, it's a week to take very seriously. It's a week to be devoted to God, according to that definition. It's a week to be empowered by God. And it's a week to show others what it means to be holy, just the way Jesus showed us in the way he served and loved. I find it a bit scary, to be honest, the prospect of being like Jesus. He's asking an awful lot, and I'm not sure I always want to give what he wants. I rather like my little grudges, which I've been known to nurse and nurture just to keep them warm. And those occasional feelings of superiority that I sometimes have, well, I'm not sure I'm ready to give them up. But I suppose I have to. In fact, I'm pretty sure I have to. I can't see any way to have a good Holy Week if I'm still holding grudges, still thinking myself superior and better than others, and still being choosy about who gets the benefit of my talents. I really hope for myself that it is a good week, a challenging week, a really holy week. And I hope it is for you as well.
And a warm thanks there for that reflection from Scottish Jesuit priest, Father Chris Bowles. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.